secrets that I can't keep. Like in my heart there's that hotel suite, and you lived there so long. It's kind of strange now you're gone. I'm not sure if I should show you what I found. Has it gone for good, or is it coming back around? Isn't it hard to make up your mind when you're losing and your fuse is fireside? There's all those places we used to go, and I suspect you already know. But that place on memory lane you liked still looks the same, but something about it's changed. Not sure if I should show you what I found. Has it gone for good, or is it coming back around? Isn't it hard to make up your mind when you're losing and your fuse is fireside? And I thought I was yours forever. Or maybe I was mistaken, but I just cannot manage to make it through the day without thinking that you were lately.
Right from the start, just some kind of heaven. That's all that I need. I found it in you. I found it in you. Just some kind of heaven. That's all that I need. I found it in you. You're too good to be true. You got me singing, baby. Do 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 do. Hell to make me scared of love. I don't need a symphony to sing my song, cause there's a choir of angels deep inside my lungs, and I can hear them sing.
Let's spend this night together. Let me make you mine. I know when we're together, my setting sun will shine. Let's spend this night together. Let me make you mine.
I found it in you. You're some kind of hell.
matter to me. If you really feel that you need some time to be free, time to go out searching for yourself, hoping to find time to go to find. It don't matter to me if you take up with someone who's better than me, 'cause your happiness is all I want for you to find. Be your peace of mind. A lot of people have an ego hang up 'cause they wanna be the only one. How many came before? It really doesn't matter, just as long as you're the last. Everybody moving on and trying to find out what's been missing in the past. And it don't matter to me if your searching brings you back together with me, 'cause there'll always be an empty room waiting for you, an open heart waiting for you. Time is on my side, 'cause it don't matter to me. Don't matter to me. It 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 don't matter to me. 'Cause there'll always be an empty room waiting for you, an open heart waiting for you. Time is on my side, 'cause it don't matter to me.
And just as you heard there, dear listeners, obviously as it introduces the first 10 minutes of this morning's session here, of my Sunday morning take, yeah, you know, bringing you in some, okay, it's a mixed bag of you know, the specific genres, but nonetheless, starting off your Sunday morning on my Sunday morning take from 5 to 7 a.m. here, every Sunday morning session on Eagle FM. Good morning, good morning, good morning, and welcome, as we always do here, talking about the interesting, the particularly interesting, and sometimes even the downright peculiar in many scenarios, that obviously being around about the natural world, and obviously those particular events that us humanity have instigated, created, or actually contributed greatly towards. Now, as we obviously look towards the particular conversation, ours is based upon the specific event technically on the 4th of May, and not on the 3rd, of a specific workers, if I should rather call it a protest, that took place. And it actually helps to solidify the global movement, or the global celebration, not movement, celebration of what was recently just now celebrated, the 1st of May, which is obviously the public holiday that many of you Namibians enjoyed, obviously, but probably you've never asked why is there a holiday on the 1st of May primarily. Now, the particular event we're going to be talking about actually solidifies, after it took place, it solidifies the 1st of May celebration in its own right. But it's the happenings of the day. It's the situation created within the first industrial revolution that actually creates the template, the scenarios, the conditions that you look forward to, wherever you find yourself, primarily also enjoying the particular, you know, employment conditions that you find yourself in, wherever. It's literally this particular event that actually put things into motion in order to structure the global employment market. Now, there obviously are still certain countries in the world that have variations in terms of how, you know, employment laws are adapted in their economies, for their industries, for their particular, you know, systems. But however, you will find a template in terms of that there's a structure in terms of what's the maximum allowable time frame of hours to be worked. If it's something that needs to run 24 hours, do you have shift basis, or do you have a system where you have multiple people that can rotate in order to do a certain particular function, so on and so forth. Now, sticking to the 1st of May's particular explanation, and, you know, many people would obviously know May Day is just, you know, the celebration from workers. But very few people actually recognize that it actually comes from the very country that today is greatly anti-union, worker union, for that matter. The very country who is now in one or other way trying to espouse a particular facade of, no, you know, direct negotiation between employee and employer are, you know, is something that can take place. True, it can take place like that. And it's the very country also that is now at the forefront of the AI unemployment trend. No, really, guys. Every week, every day, I view some of the very worrying economic data and discussions that come out of the United States' own employment or job market. You guys would not believe the particular scenarios that are happening. For example, the whole of 2025, and I know we, you know, on the home run specifically, myself and Helmut, we were looking into the particular jobs that will be impacted when the advent of AI is completely rolled out. But when you literally look into, you just wait a year later, literally just a year later, guys. I mean, it was in this particular period, this first 4 or 5 months last year, when the World Economic Forum, specifically at the start of the World Economic Forum of 2025, brought out the Future of Jobs report. And, you know, we extensively went through the Future of Jobs report, highlighting the impacts that AI would have on various jobs that you could also see in Namibia and around the world. Which one of these jobs would be greatly affected? And there was even a gradient, you know, from most impacted to least impacted. The concern has been, dear listeners, that unfortunately, it seems like AI hasn't even added any productivity, hasn't upscaled any productivity in some companies and in some sectors in the United States. I'll say it again. It has not added any productivity. It hasn't proven past humanity's particular input, inputs in certain scenarios. It has not. It has not. And that is besides, that's just productivity. That's besides the aspect of ensuring that, you know, the particular product brought out is in some cases of an equal quality. So, I've given you that particular template. But the question I'm going to ask you is, how many of you, and obviously we don't want, you know, sort of like now, you know, people putting up their hands like in a classroom. No, just think to yourself, huh? Did you know that literally the global union, labor union movement technically comes from the United States? Did you know that? Did you know that the global establishment of the 8-hour day, the 8-hour working day comes from the United States? Did you know that? Did you know that even the ILO, its particular roots and its formations or whatever emanates from all the developments that happened in the first industrial revolution, specifically in the United States of America. It has its particular first roots coming emanating from that country. Did you know that? Didn't come from the Soviet Union. It didn't come from any of the European nations. It came from an outlier outside of the European context at the time. And obviously that the context at the time was that Europe was the superpower. They were the colonizers. They were colonizing other countries. They were in charge of other nations where they were just extracting raw materials from. And we see the same template today. We see it. So, on the 4th of May, a particular event took place in Chicago, known as the Haymarket Affair. It was a peaceful protest by labor protesters in Chicago against police brutality that turned deadly when an unidentified individual threw a bomb into the crowd and the police responded with random gunfire. So this individual threw this particular, let's call it an accelerant into the discussion, because the event actually was that Haymarket is a square in Chicago. All these protesters walked to Haymarket, and the mayor of Chicago, the mayor, came to observe what this protest was about. And then everything was resolved, and the people went home. But we'll get also into that. And then, obviously, things sped up from a specific point when someone threw something, an explosive, into this particular crowd. But the people were already dispersing. Then the police just decided to respond with gunfire. Now, this particular event, the Haymarket Affair, left as many as 15, or slightly more, because it's technically slightly more, as many as 15 people that were killed, including 7 police officers and dozens that were injured. Now, it became known as the Haymarket Affair and resulted in widespread anger directed against immigrants and labor leaders. Now, Haymarket, in its own right, actually started with a poster. The poster's right here in front of me in terms of my literature. The poster just reads outright, mass meeting tonight at 7:30 o'clock. This was primarily a platform, obviously, to, voice the concerns of factory workers and the particular, I won't say concessions, but the particular sort of like negotiating points that they would like to put on the table with whoever they were obviously going to meet with. Because remember, at the time, guys, it's not like today. Protests were still a new thing. But town hall meetings and town square meetings and square meetings were something. I mean, for example, if you go and view, I won't say go to Italy right now, but go and view every Italian, Spanish, Portuguese major town. You'll even find it in many South American towns. The town is designed in a way that there's always a square. So a square is, yes, besides it obviously being perfectly square-ish, a perfect square designed, laid out and designed in terms of town planning. But the square functions as a central meeting point at many cases. For example, if you think about in companies where you've got an assembly point, in the case of an emergency at a company, an assembly point means let's all meet here when a fire breaks out, when there's other kinds of hazardous scenarios, or where there's any other kind of emergency situation. We meet at this particular point. We all gather there to take stock in a safe space, technically, and to then know the next step to take from there. The concern was obviously That's in a company sense, you know, that you would still be pretty close to the property. For a square design and town planning, or in what the countries that I, most Latin speaking countries that I just highlighted, no, Latin language countries, is that this is part, technically part of their layout and their design. That's how they build their towns and their cities. So from cities like Florence, even to Italy, Florence to the north, Turin to Milan to Rome to wherever, you'll find a square. You go to South America, you'll find a square. Why? Because at that stage, if you wanted information back in the 1800s and earlier, everyone was told, come to the square, we have the mayor is going to say something. It's not like here in Namibia now in the 22nd century where if the mayor of City of Anuk is going to say something, it's just, you know, you can watch it from the comfort of wherever. It's literally the particular purpose. So, the particular meeting was obviously scheduled on 4 May at the Haymarket Square meeting poster. Not the meeting poster, I outlined literally the Haymarket mass meeting. And it was scheduled for 4 May in 1886. That was the Haymarket Affair. Now, the Haymarket Affair obviously was the violent confrontation, the aftermath between the police and labor protesters in Chicago. And it became the symbol of the international struggle for workers' rights. It has been also associated with May Day, meaning the 1st of May, since that day's designation as an International Workers' Day by the 2nd International in 1889. Now, we will talk about the 2nd International, just so that you can have an understanding specifically about what the 2nd International was. But before we continue, guys, we'll quickly take a short musical break and we come back right after this.
Have I told you lately that I love you? Well, if I didn't, then I'm sorry.
instead of falling on. So keep your head up, your wings wide. Find fire that keeps your soul alive. So keep your head up, your mind strong. Let go instead of falling on.
Coming back there from the sounds specifically of Take That with Keep Your Head Up. Before that, it was a little bit of the Black Keys with the song I Forgot to Be Your Lover. And obviously, as you find yourself here in my company from 5 to 7 a.m., we come back to where we left off on this morning's discussion of My Sunday Morning Take. Now, the Haymarket Affair is obviously outlined, laid the foundation specifically for many particular, positives, like the 1st of May celebration globally, as well as also the designation, the 1st of May's particular designation at a particular event known as the Second International in 1889. Can you guys believe it? This public holiday is technically as old as Christmas itself, as, the formalization, the formal celebration of Christmas. But not too much, The Second International itself was a federation of socialist parties and trade unions that greatly influenced the ideology, the policy, and the methods of the European labor movement from the last decade of the 19th century to the beginning of the First World War. So we're talking there between 1890 up to 1914, basically. And obviously, if you're going to ask me, why did it end? Well, if you had to look at the 1914 war situation, it was literally all hands to the pump. It was you sign up to the army or you work in the factories. And if the war went on too long, the situation was those men that were in the factories would also later on be asked or be forced to sign up to the army. And then you've got severe shortages primarily in your country, specifically with who's going to work in the factories. And that's also where women were later on allowed to do factory work and specifically also to participate in the particular dangerous work situations and environments in factories. Now, and that's also still besides the equality discussion with regards to compensation and, employment conditions between men and women. In many scenarios, you would see, there was this lovely story that I was once told about. If you don't have women working in your company or in your business, you sit with a very peculiar situation. Now, one of the peculiar situations was that it was a study done on a workshop, like a mechanic workshop or something like that. Then men, if it was just men, they would either be playing practical jokes too much on each other. Things would become very tense in some cases. Some men wouldn't work with others, or there would be some confrontations or confrontational situations as well. Or it would be a scenario specifically where the workplace environment it wasn't hostile, but it was just not conducive enough to achieve the necessary level of, performance that you obviously as the manager of that department or division or whatever, or the business owner, that you would envisage for yourself. But the moment that women were brought in, before I get to the moment that women were, or the other scenario would also have been if there were younger men who needed to be trained, you would, there was always the situation of the older men in the work team who wouldn't want to even help guide or coach the younger men in terms of doing the job properly. And in many cases, when I think back also in my own particular personal career path, whether it be in the former sales function in advertising or in the current media space, I actually see the same particular trend. The older men didn't easily help me. I had to find out from women, my female colleagues who was either older than me, or, you know, they were just there a little bit longer, but I learned more from women than I did from men, which is a fascinating thing to also come to a realization. Because if you think back to your own particular career path and you go like, okay, so who were the particular mentors in your office or in your team at that stage? And you get to realize, oh, okay, so this was the particular situation. And it was very funny. In many cases, you don't even notice it as much. But when you go and actually sit and think about it, like I described it to you right now, you get to a realization, oh, so the opposite genders help each other's particular younger, team members to understand the job better, to fit into the job a lot easier, to be able to do this and to be able to do that. And I've even seen it with myself now, trying also to coach and, you know, specifically when we here at Eagle FM get some interns, you know, but now and then I try to coach the, you know, both genders, equally. And then in many scenarios, you see which one of the two genders actually listens to a senior colleague, specifically a senior colleague that is of the opposite gender. You'll see who listens to who. If it's younger women, they will listen to an older man. If it's younger man, they will easily listen to an older woman. I don't know if it's a parenting situation, guys. I'm just highlighting to you. I really don't know. But I've observed it just now. I've had an epiphany and I've come to the realization, it's pretty weird. However, getting back to where we left off. So, now the Second International was founded at a congress in Paris in 1889, literally the same year as the Haymarket Affair. Now, unlike the First International, it was based on the membership of national parties and trade unions only, specifically. It was not centralized, it was not a centralized organization like the First, but rather a loose federation that did not set up an executive body, the International Socialist Bureau, until only 11 years after its particular foundation. Now, its headquarters was in Brussels, where the Second Congress of the International met in 1891, and the Congresses met in a number of cities at various intervals and not on a yearly basis, meaning they didn't make it annually, but they did meet in other places as well to try and obviously promote and spread the word. Now, the Congresses also technically saw that by 1912, the Second International represented the socialist and the social democratic parties of all European countries, the United States, Canada, and Japan, with a voting strength of nearly 9 million participants. Now, although it had no mandatory power, it was recognized by its member parties as their highest moral authority. Back then, you know, morality was a thing. It was pretty strong currency, as opposed, obviously, in today's particular world, where you have to define what is morals and what is law. Now, the Second International stood for parliamentary democracy and finally, at its London Congress in 1896, expelled from its ranks the anarchists, because we will also get to the anarchists in our discussion for today, who opposed the particular parliamentary democracy process. Now, after much debate, the Second International rejected the theory of the gradual achievement of socialism and cooperation with non-socialist parties in office, and it also reaffirmed the Marxist doctrine of the class struggle and the inevitability of revolution. But its main concern, however, was the prevention of a general European war. Because who gets sent to war, guys? You just have to ask that particular question. Who gets sent to war? Who gets told, sign up for conscription, you need to be trained in the army, any able-bodied man between whatever age and whatever age, you guys need to be ready to go and fight. And this makes things interesting. Because it would mean, for example, in hypothetically, when you look at a labor union, it is probably the biggest fear that a labor union has, that if their members were signed up to a war, you know, to defend the borders of a country, or to go and invade another country, or to do whatever, and so on and so forth. The first and single biggest threat for a labor union is losing members. And specifically members who would be fighting, who would be dying, who would come back with severe traumatic disorders from the various particular, cruelties that they either experienced, observed, participated in, and how do you move forward from specifically people like that who were so severely scarred for the rest of their lives. I mean, just the conversation just a little bit earlier, the particular podcast product that you heard just before we started with this morning's My Sunday Morning Take was a discussion of, you know, gradually developing your wealth, converting from an 8-to-5, or in our case, it's an 8-to-5, in other parts of the world, it's supposedly 9-to-5. Converting from a 8-to-5, 9-to-5 situation to becoming an asset owner or an asset, you know, investor, something like that. Now, how do you gradually develop that wealth situation? Well, that is if you've gradually avoided conflict as a country, you've negated any particular volatile situations, and you maintain stability as far as possible. Obviously, that is Namibia's particular template that I'm explaining. For 36 years, which is a generation, we have avoided conflict en masse. Since 1990 up until now, we've avoided it. So, this means that there is a gradual movement of wealth creation continuing on and on and on and on and on. The stability element just allows the growth to continue on and on and on. Parents who were 8-to-5 or 9-to-5 operators, meaning they were also employed, had the opportunity to retire with their retirement packages, thus reinvesting back into their children. The children had gone, but in the process, while they were working, the children had gone to university, had achieved various particular certifications, industry certifications and the lot, and those children are now adults as well in this economy today, and they are now participating in your economy, owning and dispensing of assets. And so the wealth accumulation just continues on and on and on. But it wasn't so easy back in 1896. It wasn't. Okay, for us, Namibia, back in 1896, we were a colony. Straightforward. Just we were technically under conflict at that stage. So the imminent particular general European war, which was the overarching not-so-nice thing to take into consideration, and it was inevitable because it was going to happen. And, here's an interesting thing also to interject just a little bit, quickly. Another guy on YouTube came up with a particular theory regarding the actual start of the First World War, not the second, of the First World War. Apparently it was the behavior of he was going to become the king of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, or the emperor. And apparently, this guy, this royal, was so bad at his, you know, okay, let me not say you know, at his philandering, let's use the actual term, he technically had caused so much, you know, consternation, specifically in Austria, because his cousin was the guy that was assassinated in was it Zagreb or Belgrade? Here in the Balkans, it was his cousin, the Archduke Franz Ferdinand. He was the guy that was assassinated, and the concern was that apparently he should have been there. This cousin, this other guy, the actual heir to the Austro-Hungarian empire, should have been there, but his cousin was sent, you know, as a sort of like you would send a minister instead of having a prime minister there situation. Just for the situation to unravel in that the Archduke being obviously the victim of the day, you know, obviously passing away from the gunshot wound. Now, many people actually said, okay, so what did the Archduke do? You know, was there something that the Archduke did? Did he do something? Well, the concern was there were also some rumblings happening in the south of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which we call today Croatia, Slovenia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, and what's the other country's name? And Kosovo. Yeah, Kosovo, which is just a city. All those territories, which later on became Yugoslavia, and Yugoslavia fragmented up into those small territories, those smaller countries. All that whole block that was formerly known as Yugoslavia, they all were starting to rumble, and, you know, the rumblings were nationalism, and it was what we call tribalism, this side, you know, it became ethno-nationalism, you know, and there was some sort of something boiling under the surface in the Balkans, you know, and the discussion was, well, let's try and manage this particular rumbling or rumblings happening in the Balkans. And obviously, the rest is history from there. When Franz Ferdinand got shot, everything was, you know, just went out the window at that time. Now, just ending up specifically on the Second International, the global labor movement, which only basically represented the, you know, as mentioned right now, the countries of Europe, Japan, Canada, and the United States. So the Second International ended, you know, in terms of trying to avoid a general European war. But after extended debate, it also rejected the use of a general strike to ward off the imminent danger of a general European war. So they had the option of to stop the European war from happening, because technically people don't know what was going on. Why was another war being instigated? They had the biggest tool at the time to avoid loss of life. They didn't use it. However, the Second International then demanded the introduction of compulsory courts of arbitration for the settlement of disputes between nations, and the reduction of armaments with total disarmament as the ultimate aim. So you can obviously see where this disarmament rhetoric also comes from, and it comes through from the labor unions at the time. Now, in a resolution that was drafted by Vladimir Lenin, Rosa Luxemburg, and L. Martov, and adopted by its Stuttgart Conference in 1907, However, the International pledged its member parties in belligerent countries to use the social and economic crisis brought about by the war to promote social revolution. So, getting back to the Haymarket Affair, which, you know, in its own right, had contributed greatly specifically to what we know today, and the Second International was just sort of like a, you know, just filling in the particular gap situation. So, on 3 May, one person was killed and several injured, obviously, with the Haymarket Affair when, you know, the people went to go and strike. And this was after people intervened, or the police, sorry, put the police intervened to protect strikebreakers and intimidate strikers during a union action at the McCormick Harvesting Machine Company that was part of a national campaign to secure an 8-hour workday. So, the national campaign for the 8-hour workday, which is the standard 8-hour workday that you enjoy in Namibia, was first being, you know, explored and demanded in the United States. Now, to protest police brutality, anarchist labor leaders called a mass meeting the next day in the Haymarket Square. Now, I have to highlight here to you, dear listeners, the term anarchists was, it's a little bit interesting to highlight in this particular conversation, because these were the guys back then who were trying to stop anything, any aspect of ownership from taking place. But you also found them in many countries post-colonialism. I mean, when you actually look at a discussion specifically for many countries in the global south post-colonialism, you get to an indication of some particular political leaders being, you know, do they fit into the realm specifically through the speeches they give in an anarchist aspect, or do they fit into an authoritarian aspect? Because in many scenarios, anarchists, what was also discovered, which we also now found out specifically in this morning's particular discussion, many of the anarchists were also anti-democratic. They didn't like democracy or any democratic process from taking place. You know, to ensure that everyone has a voice or something, or, you know, voices, concerns, anarchists were also in a way against any democratic processes. No votings. They should just be an imposition of a system, an imposition of a character. Despite the character's flaws, this character is, by, you know, be all and end all, will be our leader. But the character probably has got rampant anger. Is probably suffering from rampant alcoholism. Is probably suffering from one or other particular character flaw, which could be that they might have long fingers, or they could be someone that loves embezzling funds, or that loves hiring only their family, things like that. And the particular aspect, obviously, of anarchists in the labor movement was that they try to rile people up. And you see it also in South Africa a lot. Just go to South Africa. You'll see it a lot. You can, if you want a clear-cut explainer or clear-cut indicator of someone that acts like an anarchist, Malema is the best. Malema is the best example you will find of an anarchist. He's the best. Many of his statements are inflammatory. Many of the particular public engagements around topics of national interest were inflammatory, or were instigating something for an inflammatory purpose. They always bring in anarchy. You know, it's always chaos that they call for. Chaos must always be the answer. Violence must always be the answer. And this particular conversation was something that unfortunately, guys, began between the labor movements of the 1800s as well. We can't deny it. History has observed it. And it is currently still, in an African context, present. Now, before we continue, guys, we'll quickly take a short musical break. After that, we'll come back, head into the rest of this morning's program here on your number one talkery station. This is my Sunday Morning Take. We'll be back right after this.
Let's take our time.
Thank you. sanctuary. If I slip to my sanity, respiration is a counter strike against the giants, and the rats are like, oh, but you go through the shadows, yeah, you and your dancing shoes, oh, you. So good at writing tomorrow, would you take me with you?
What it means to Now, coming back there from the sounds of Norah Jones with the song Queen of the Sea. Before that, you had a little bit of Paolo Nutini with the song Desperation. And once again, take that with We Got All Day. Now, the developments that we obviously left off at in terms of looking at what caused the Haymarket affair or the Haymarket event was obviously that, you know, something happened on 3 May, which led to a meeting being organized on 4 May, the next day. Now, that gathering was actually pronounced peaceful by the mayor of Chicago at the time, Carter Harrison, who attended as an observer. Now, after Harrison and most of the demonstrators departed, and actually after they left, you know, after conversations had been completed, a contingent of police arrived and demanded that the crowd disperse. Now, at that point, a bomb was thrown by an individual never positively identified, and police responded with random gunfire. 7 police officers were killed and 60 others were wounded before the violence ended, with civilian casualties having been estimated at least 4 to 8 dead and 30 to 40 injured. Now, remember, all of this happened on 4 May, this particular event. Now, the Haymarket affair created widespread hysteria that was directed against immigrants and labor leaders. Amid the panic, a gentleman by the name of August Spies, yes, that is his surname, but if you read in Afrikaans, Spies, which technically means spear, you can technically where we see where we're going. So, a gentleman by the name of August Spies and 7 other anarchists were convicted of murder on the grounds that they had conspired with or aided an unknown assailant. The assailant that threw the bomb. Supposedly, the blame was placed on the labor leaders. Now, many of the so-called Chicago 8, however, were not even present at the May 4 event. And the allegation was that they were involved, or that their involvement was never even proven. The Chicago 8, as mentioned, included August Spies and the 7 other anarchists, as outlined. And this obviously should show you an indicator that, okay, something weird's going on here. You know, how can you just, for the sake of being associated to something, in name so far, be automatically thought of that you were there to instigate the situation. But that's not the worst of the discussion. Now, nevertheless, Spies and 3 other defendants were hanged on 11 November 1887, later that year, and another defendant committed suicide. Now, in 1893, you know, obviously a whole 6 years later, basically, an Illinois governor by the name of John Peter Altgeld was petitioned by a criminal attorney, Clarence Darrow, and others to grant clemency to the surviving 3 men. You remember that 3 were hanged, 1 committed suicide, and there were only 3 other suspects left. Or suspects, according to the police, without any actual proof of said suspects actually being, you know, the instigators of the said event. Now, Clarence Darrow and other lawyers obviously didn't give up on this particular development regarding the Haymarket affair. They should technically have called it the Haymarket Massacre. Since we're also pretty close to, for example, just tomorrow is Kasinga Day, and that in itself was a similar situation where there was just, you know, violence meted out against people who were not armed and who weren't armed combatants in any manner or form. Now, studying the transcript of the case, the governor, Altgeld, concluded that the defendants had not been given a fair trial because the judge was biased, the jury packed in the prosecution's favor, and much of the evidence was actually fabricated. Now, Altgeld also made a decision to issue the pardons, which was widely condemned by industrialists and the conservative press, but it was applauded by the labor reformers at the time. The Haymarket Affair had also a lasting effect on the labor movement in the United States. It helped to also establish the Knights of Labor, the KOL. Yes, literally, that's what they did back then in the 1800s. They had these weird names, which at the time, you know, had tried to speak to a position of higher morality, and saying, you know, we take the higher moral ground in terms of trying to be the best people we wish to be, instead of the situation where we take the best, just purely strategic position in any ground situation. So the Knights of Labor at the time were the largest and most successful union organization in the United States, and it was blamed for this incident as well. Now, while the KOL also had sought an 8-hour day during the event specifically of what caused all of this, what was the basis of all of this, was the national dispute in the U.S. around the amount of hours that people were working in the factories. Now, while they were also pursuing the same particular endeavor of an 8-hour workday and had called several strikes themselves, the KOL, to achieve that goal, the KOL's involvement in the riot could never be proven. Now, public distrust, however, caused many of the KOL locals to join the newly formed and less radical American Federation of Labor. Now, the Haymarket tragedy inspired generations, obviously, of labor leaders, leftists, activists, and artists, and has also been commemorated in monuments, murals, and posters throughout the world, especially in Europe and in Latin America itself. By 1893, the Haymarket Martyrs Monument was also erected in a cemetery in Chicago's suburb of Forest Park, and the statue, obviously dedicated to the slain police officers, was erected in Haymarket Square in 1889, but it was moved to the Chicago Police Department's Training Academy in the early 1970s, after it was repeatedly damaged by leftist radicals once again, because back in the 70s, you had the hippies and the, you know, the anti-Vietnam War protesters and all that, you know, obviously happening in the United States. It's actually interesting specifically when you look at the histories of countries. And just after ending here at the Haymarket scenario, I watched another particular podcast by, what is the guy's name? Okay, it wasn't him. It was actually Tucker Carlson, who interviewed the former CIA agent John Kiriakou. If you've never seen Kiriakou's particular international relations analysis, with a deep twist of only his insight specifically, because he was in great length, according to him, obviously, positioned a lot in Eastern Europe, specifically in Greece and in other parts of the world. Now, Kiriakou told Tucker Carlson back in last month, you know, what does the situation look like in the United States, specifically with regarding, you know, the confusing messaging coming through from the politicians in the U.S. and other particular, you know, severe impacts coming through from the technology companies in the United States as well, and then also the global relations that the U.S. has, which is at an all-time low. And a conversation point was asked, you know, where do you think the United States is in this current position? Now, just to put in a little bit of a disclaimer here, hate it or love it, dear listeners. Hate the United States or love the United States. It's up to you, but primarily the cause is that the United States technically was some sort of a weight or an anchor in certain particular positives that helped to shape the world we know today. Now, when I say that helped to shape the world today, the United Nations was started was a brainchild of the United States. The same too, also the precursor organization known as the League of Nations was also a brainchild of the United States. the British and the French were not interested. They didn't want to provide independences to their colonies or the colonial territories, because they felt, why should the colonial territories be on an equal standing as them? That was the politics of the day. It was ugly. It was very racist, but it was straightforward. And I obviously highlighted that specifically last year with the, you know, what led to, the actual breakup of the League of Nations. And one of the answers is, no, it was a whole bunch of wars that built up, that were unsettled, you know, international relations tensions that built up to the Second World War. Not really. It was because of Australia, which had a very, 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 unpopular, well, for Australia, he was a popular politician as a prime minister. But in terms of the international relations realm, he was unpopular specifically with Japan and with Abyssinia at the time. Abyssinia was the territory of Eritrea and Ethiopia today. You call Abyssinia, with Somalia and Somaliland on the other side. You call that Abyssinia. That was the old territory's name, the old country's name. So the whole reason why the League of Nations failed was because there was an Australian Prime Minister who refused to acknowledge that all people are equal. He refused that, because if you go look at the UN's founding document, they literally stipulated that all people are equal. Meaning, it doesn't matter what skin color you have, everybody has equal, has access automatically to the same equal rights. It's not something that someone conveys to you at their leisure or when they feel about it. You get it, straightforward, no questions asked. It's not even a debate. It's just there automatically. For example, like the debate back here in Namibia in the 90s at one stage, where should corporal punishment still be a talking point? It took me a little bit of a while because, you know, in some cases, you know, if you were naughty at home, when I say naughty, well, your parents would interpret it as naughty, but the interpretation to you would be, you know, you were just having some fun doing whatever it is that you were doing at the time that was deemed naughty. Then you would get a spanking. You know, and sometimes the spanking was, it had a bit too much investment in it sometimes, depending obviously on the severity of the fun that you had. But when you look at it, there was a drive back then in the 90s, specifically just leading up to the year 2000, because I was on secondary school at that time, just made it to high school. 98, I was in grade 8, 99, obviously grade 9. The conversation moved in 1998 into 1999 on specifically schools outside of Windhoek. You know, how should teachers try to intervene and install discipline in a class? Now, when you look at it, you're looking at a similar situation specifically to, like, with labor rights. It was a discussion of, how do you balance having discipline in a class full of teenagers who are obviously rampant with their own hormones and their own capacities and who obviously are full of life because they're way younger, you know, they've got all this energy to burn. How do you manage that enthusiasm, excitement, elements or aspects and still be able to deliver the syllabus that you're in charge of? Now, I know to the teachers who probably would be awake by now and listening, and if you've woken up, good morning, and, you know, once again, thank you for tuning in to your number one talk radio station. But when you think about it, the biggest balance was always, you know, how do you get the lesson started? Because everything is about time. You're an adult. Everything is about time. You're dealing with young adults, or they're not young adults. Young adults are actually from 18, 19. You're dealing with adolescents who are teenagers. You know, to them, they are discovering the world in different scenarios per year, every year. And
what is it that they that you want them to achieve besides just delivering the syllabus to them? And at that stage, it was a discussion nationally, because it was in the newspapers then, about should corporal punishment still be something that should be allowed. The founding president, former President Nyoma at the time, said no, corporal punishment is bad. He literally took that position. And you can, if you don't believe me, you can go and find him in the archives of, I think, okay, the two automatic newspapers I think about. You will find those archived articles. And I was a little bit puzzled as a teenager. I'll show it to you, because you also see this specifically in, like, in the labor movements back, even in the 1800s, even in today. People who are not part of a union, but they see how members of a union act, and you're like, what does this mean? You know, if we act this way, are we not probably, you know, making things a little bit more inflammatory? Isn't there a way to negotiate properly? How do we approach this? Is it better if I don't join a union, or is it better if I join a union? And it was a similar situation. It was literally the similar arguments I had back in high school when, because I remember the one lesson we had, it was my final year in Rehoboth, not on high school, just in Rehoboth. We were busy in the process of moving to Windhoek. And the one boy in my class told our home teacher, you know, the teacher whose class you are, you know, corporal punishment is going to be, it's going to be banned. It's going to become illegal. And I still remember that teacher's response till this day, guys. And she said it with such, you know, when you try to tell a child, I will do it. Since you already provoked me, I will do it. That was her mentality at the time. She literally responded to the guy, because this boy in my class, his mother was also a teacher. And yes, in a town like Rehoboth, you know, the teachers know each other technically. Whether they are at different schools or not, they know each other. And the teacher in our classroom responded to him by saying, we've got a right to be children. I was sat that day, I was like, who gave you the, I couldn't believe it with my own ears, but I sat there thinking to myself, who gave you that right? Which power empowered you? Which authority empowered you with this perceived ownership of a right to violate someone else's particular, firstly, their own particular space, secondly, their body, because you're violating someone else's body if you beat them up, or you beat them, or you strike them with anything. And I sat there thinking that day, until the day even, you know, whole 20 years, whatever time frame later on, you sit there thinking, what was going through that teacher's mind at that time by giving that response? Was it just a response just to respond? Or was it a response that was logical, that made sense? How do you own the right to beat someone else? Now, the example, the case study that I just delivered to you was a case study to literally show you the thinking. This is now obviously of past generations. That teacher, obviously, that I had at that time, she would obviously be part of the baby boomer. They are part of the baby boomer generation. They were the generation that had to rebuild after certain particular events in human history. And also, they were also the generations that had to, firstly, they enjoyed a whole bunch of benefits, first and foremost. You know, cheaper access to land, cheaper access to goods. They had the motivation to marry earlier. My goodness, guys, if you can marry at the age of 30 even, you are lucky. You are privileged even if you can marry at the age of 30. But you know what's the worst thing? Do you know who I'll be describing? I'll be describing, if the man is 30, then he's probably got a rich father, just like Gary Stevenson has highlighted. If the woman is 30, then the husband is probably 40. It's the way life goes, guys. I can't, you know, describe any other situation to you. It's the way life goes. That is the template that exists out there in the world. So, if you marry at the age of 30, if you're a woman, your husband is probably 40. Because he's not 35. I'm sorry, he's definitely not 35. 35, homeboy's probably still sweating it out. He's probably still got sweaty palms, and he's working really hard, you know, to try and sort out some things. But if you're 30, he's probably 40. And if the guy's 30, he's probably got a rich dad. So, before we take the next short musical break, dear listeners, which obviously brings us up to the time frame of, you know, almost close to 6:30, do remember that you're in the company of yours truly, myself, Dwight, here on your number one talk radio station. This is my Sunday morning take. Every Sunday morning, where we obviously go through everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and a little bit of everything else in between, as we obviously try to make sense of the developments and certain particular important elements in natural, they call it natural history, which includes geography, the subject matter of geography, and human history. We'll be back right after this. Come back there from the sounds of Rodrigo Amarante with Mare. And once again, dear listeners, we're into the fourth quarter of this morning session here on the number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM. This is my Sunday morning take. If you've just woken up, I do hope you've got a cup of coffee in your hands. And for some reason, I don't see the first light. Wow. So, this obviously is an indicator that winter is approaching. Do get your warm stuff out. Yeah, to get it out. I've been making the mistake for the past couple of nights, specifically of not, you know, being warm enough. Meaning I have enough blankets. I'm not talking about anything else in between, guys. Just blankets. But where we left off primarily, the discussion obviously that we looked at was obviously based upon the Haymarket affair and the particular event that obviously took place there. And just a little bit of some side note regarding like the 1st of May's particular, it starts, its roots in this discussion is that, and there's a lovely photo I've got here in front of me in terms of a protest or a march that happened on the 1st of May 1909 in New York City, which was then the first inaugural indication of Workers' Day. And they had a whole, you know, protest. Well, not on protest, it was just a basic march, you know, it was just a march. Now, obviously, its name as we know it as May Day, which is the day to commemorate the historic struggles and gains by workers and the labor movement, also called the International Workers' Day, is that it is observed on 1 May in many countries and is a public holiday in countries such as India, South Africa, China, Germany, France, Spain, Portugal, and Greece, just to name a few. Namibia obviously included in there, but in the US and in Canada, a similar observance is known as Labor Day, which occurs on the first Monday of September. So it's literally towards the middle of the year for Canada and the United States. Now, they obviously call it Labor Day in Canada and the United States. For many other countries, it's known as International Workers' Day, and it obviously has its own particular significance because it was designated by international, what's that phrase they call it? Not negotiation, but more like international input on which particular day should be indicated as International Workers' Day. Now, the origin obviously finds itself in the United States, where workers struggled to reduce their working hours, which often stretched from 14 to 20-hour working days. Imagine working 20 hours a day. You only had 4 hours of sleep and rest to recuperate and get up and work again. Now, increasingly, the demand for a shorter workday was raised alongside demands for increased wages. Now, as industrialization increased in the early 19th century, workers began organizing themselves into trade unions to demand humane conditions. And by 1837, under the, well, a specific president, known as Van Buren, or his surname was Van Buren at the time. Okay, Van Buren is a city in the United States, just so that you know. And it was also started in 1839. But a 10-hour working day back then in 1837 was established for government workers at least. Now, this 10-hour workday was, however, not universal, and the struggle to make it so continued for the next few decades. So that technically means, yeah, these like government workers, they're always lucky, guys. Sometimes I'm just so envious of you guys. For example, like the other day, you guys got like, you could go home at like 10 o'clock in the morning. I still remember on the one particular scenario, this is one of the WhatsApp groups, the media WhatsApp groups that I'm also on. The PRO of the ministry comes and says, we are working. And then one of the journalists just comes back and says, but I thought you guys were told to go home at 10 a.m. already. Well, what are you doing? So obviously tongue in cheek, it's all about, you know, just for laughs and all that. But it was actually a little bit of a scenario to say, oh, okay, so this is the context. This is the particular sort of like privileges, specifically if you work in government, which you could enjoy. Now, when you look at, back to the working hours situation, which was the demon of the day in the 1800s to try and first, bring down. By the 1850s, this particular demand gradually evolved into the more radical and widely embraced call for an 8-hour workday. Now, the slogan they had in Australia, just to let you know, was known as 8 hours work, 8 hours recreation, and 8 hours rest. Which is wonderful. And it translates to 24 hours. You don't have to sleep for 8 hours. You go talk to any or read some of the particular psychology document, the reports that they have about what's the best amount of sleep per day for a human. You don't have to sleep the full 8 hour portion. It's more like the maximum you can sleep is technically 6. I know my maximum is technically 7. So it's a balance between 6 and 6.5 hours. For me personally, for my brain to relax, for my brain to decode, to de-stress, to uncouple from the previous day's particular, investment of energy. And you just rest. You feel refreshed when you wake up the next morning. You will feel groggy. If you've slept less than that, you will feel unhappy and you'll mumble sometimes. I know myself specifically for my every Sunday morning sessions, I have to sleep a little bit earlier the Saturday night in order to wake up at 4 a.m. obviously to be here for the Sunday morning sessions here on Eagle FM. And it's all a balance in terms of how you, you know, you ensure your body gets the maximum sort of like rest in order to just, the energy just subsides from your muscles. Your brain learns to shut down a little bit, because your brain, what happens with your brain when you sleep is that your brain actually saves the memories and in all the information it caught, it captured the previous day, it literally stores it in its memory banks through sleep. Because the moment your brain can rest, the better. So, in the 1850s, as mentioned, things became a little bit more radical, a little bit more outspoken in the for the 8-hour workday to be the theme of the day. And the impact of this demand extended beyond the United States, as workers in Australia and other countries struggled for the same particular concern. By 1856, Australian stonemasons won an 8-hour workday. By the 1860s, this demand gained influential backing when delegates from various trade unions gathered in the city of Baltimore in the United States to form the National Labor Union. Now, in the U.S., the NLU sought to unify workers across trades and passed a resolution at the inaugural meeting in 1866 that declared that the workday would be a maximum of 8 hours across all U.S. states. Pretty profound. Very well structured. Not the modern day chaos where you sometimes wonder, what are you demanding? Sorry to the unions. But in some cases, it's a scenario of, what are you actually demanding? If it's a demand to say everyone must be paid equal, you will fail. Because we saw that at the start of the year, things did not make sense at the start of the year. And you guys know which strike I'm technically talking about. It was at a private company here at the start of the year. It didn't make sense. It literally, the strike didn't make sense. Even with the information that was provided in one of the few articles that I read about it, I was like, this does not make sense. There's something else here. Something else is going on here. But however, my trained eye, I sometimes expose, you know, that thinking a little bit. And even though I don't reach the answer, because you need, the answer needs to be proof. It needs to be observed. It needs to be a fact. Needs to be written down. You know, it must be communicated. Even though I didn't see the answer, as you know, there was still a hint that something else is in the background, which is not making itself visible. However, the NLU in the United States eventually declined, but it laid the groundwork for a broader labor movement. Now, in that same year of 1866, the Geneva Congress of the First International endorsed the demand for an 8-hour workday. So as you can see, the United States has some benefits, or it has some positives, that still influence the modern day economy. The call for a shorter workday became only a small part of what May Day actually came to represent. The Federation of Organized Trades and Labor Unions of the United States and Canada, which later became the American Federation of Labor, passed a resolution in 1884 declaring that from 1 May 1886, 8 hours would constitute a legal day's labor. On 1 May 1886, we here in Namibia in 2026 are enjoying a particular benefit. A benefit that standardizes production in an economy. Now, the cause drew as many as 500,000 workers, including many unskilled and previously unorganized workers, involved in about 1,500 strikes in the U.S. The movement became widespread across major cities in the U.S. and was centered in and around Chicago. Now, ask me, guys, why Chicago? Well, because Chicago, besides the Haymarket event that took place, Chicago was also a major industrial and financial hub. It wasn't New York City. Okay, it wasn't only New York City. It was New York City and Chicago. And there was a whole bunch of industrialization taking place between the two cities. Chicago is pretty far from New York. However, they both were hubs. Now Chicago is technically some sort of like a real estate hub. That's also where Donald Trump is pretty heavy. He's got a heavy property presence in Chicago as well. Yeah, he's obviously more from New York City than from Chicago, but his previous career path before becoming a politician still is property, and it was centered primarily mostly in New York City and in Chicago, and now obviously a lot in Florida. Now, the movement obviously became widespread across the major cities in the U.S. and was centered in Chicago, where the strike became especially hostile at the Haymarket Square. But what began as a continuation of peaceful demonstrations soon turned into violent confrontation with police that we obviously know from the first half of today's show. By 1889, the Second International, an international federation of socialist groups and trade unions, designated 1 May as well as a day in support of workers, and in commemoration of the Haymarket riot in Chicago of 1886, 3 years earlier. 5 years later, the U.S. president at the time, Grover Cleveland, uneasy with the socialist origins of Workers' Day, signed a legislation to mark Labor Day, already held in some states on the first Monday of September. And so the official U.S. holiday in honor of workers was cemented in the U.S. Canada followed suit not long afterwards. But if you thought that this could not evolve any further, think again, you were mistaken. Because not just the celebration and the win for the 8-hour workday. Can you believe it, guys? Man, not I think it's just this government work, man. These guys, eh? You guys enjoy all the good stuff first before the rest of the economy. But yeah. So in Europe, 1 May was historically associated with a rural pagan festival, because technically it was mostly based upon the transition from winter to summer or spring in Europe in many scenarios. So the 1st of May actually had a clash in terms of identity and of presence. But the original meaning of the day was gradually replaced by the modern day association with the labor movement. So in the Soviet Union, for example, leaders there embraced the new holiday, believing it would encourage workers in Europe and the United States to unite against capitalism. The day became a significant holiday in the Soviet Union and in the Eastern Bloc countries, with high-profile parades, including one in Moscow's Red Square which was presided over by top government and Communist Party functionaries, celebrating the worker and showcasing Soviet military might, because they also would include, like, you know, this is what the worker built, and a intercontinental ballistic missile follows, you know, and just immediately afterwards. And in Germany, Labor Day became an official holiday in 1933 after the rise of guess who? The Nazi Party. Now, ironically, Germany abolished free unions the day after establishing the holiday, virtually destroying Germany's labor movement. And that's what socialists do. You sometimes see, guys, that history has a weird thing of repeating itself. A very weird thing. And the particular indication has been looking at what we see in the world. And in the world, Currently right now, there's obviously sort of like forces against each other, which technically are forces which are against, for that matter, humans currently, meaning they want to take all humans out of production so that you don't have a salary, so that you become the issue of the government of the day, but the government has to collect taxes. So how does a government collect taxes? Through the salaries that people earn. Now, that was the big AI discussion. And in many cases, yes, AI helps to speed up some work processes. Let's identify it like that. It does speed up some work processes, but the concern has been AI has got such a huge impact across the economy. Jobs will be cut. They will be cut. So the concern out there in the last 5 minutes before we end is, how quickly will this happen? Will this resistance persist? The resistance against AI and the persistence for pushing AI. And the unfortunate thing has been, you can clearly see that in some cases, those that have that have access or love using a lot more political language would say this is against workers' lives or this is against the working class. But in essence, in one way or another, you can sometimes immediately identify this is almost like a, not a natural trend, but it has an element of continuous improvement of technologies and processes and manufacturing and so on and so forth will obviously lead to greater investment into streamlined processes more and more and more. Well, and on that note, dear listeners, it does bring us up to the end of this morning's My Sunday Morning Take. We'd step out for a quick musical break, and after that musical break, we say our goodbyes and we hand over to the next show. Stay tuned right after this.
Back it up slowly. Are you coming around again? You know that I'm lonely, but baby, I don't need a friend. I'll stop thinking about the same old mistakes, the time it takes for us to work it out. Can't stop thinking about the way that we talk, just never too much for us to have enough.
If you lost your show, all of that you could tungupo. omawa o tomono okuja ko NHP. Genge wa longifa elongifo lilipedu lo wawo uhaku. Olo halipiti kwa efiku nefiku. Mefiloshi shelo uhaku oe. Owa washi mali wao shosha kupako. Washika wedelwa komto alando wako. Kashi, koma punglo ena shano unjola welewe. Otodulu okulongifa omawa oe. Wa hupuko, opo unamiti toshiningi momikalo dihapungashi. Okufutila po oimali waishona. Oyo hodulu okupolwa. Ulifutila ove mwene. Oma yakulo olu hapu. Hakala ina kwa telwa. Mowa we kwa folo elo unamiti. Ile, otodulu nokuli. Okupitifa po e mwedi donumba. Tokala inofuta ea kulolo elo unamiti. Kowyalele uhapu. Talela po nhp.com.na. Ema ngono malandola fano ododina okulandulwa. NHP, rooted in care for you.
Your health, your life, your peace of mind. NHP, we're about you.
That was the sounds there specifically of St. Raymond, sort of like leading us into the end of this morning session of my Sunday Morning Take. Dear listeners, once again, if you've just woken up, unfortunately I'm done. But on the flip side of that scenario means that the programming still continues and we will still bring you the insightful discussions to follow on right after the musical break. Let's catch each other during the course of the week, where you can always find me on the Home Run, specifically where Helmut and I will be splitting open some of the conversations and some of the particular in-depth discussions, and also trying to understand, just for yourself as well, what some of these developments actually translate to. On that note, stay tuned for the rest of the programming in our company. We'll be back right after this.